from KQED. Hey everyone, from KQED Public Radio, this is Political Breakdown. I'm Marisa Lagos, a politics reporter around these here parts.
And I'm Scott Schaefer, KQED's senior politics editor. And today on The Breakdown, former state senator Mark Leno. We hear he's running for mayor of San Francisco.
That's right. Leno has led on LGBT rights, criminal justice reforms, and budget issues when he was in Sacramento. But did it prepare him for the rough and tumble world of San Francisco politics?
Well, he had a history before
that. He did. That's true.
He knows about the knife fights in the phone booth of San Francisco politics. We'll get to that in just a minute. But first, we have to chat about some things, Marisa.
Some things. What's going on?
Well, let's talk about this. Looks like it's going to be a ballot measure in November on privacy. It would give consumers more control over their data that companies like Facebook, Verizon, AT&T have. They've submitted signatures, and they think it's going to be on the ballot. And it's going to be one of those high-spending affairs. We're talking about, $100 million from the opponents probably to kill this thing?
I mean, your guess is as good as mine, but we've already seen, six-figure donations from the likes of Google, Verizon, Comcast. I mean, it's interesting, right, to see sort of the old wave of telecom companies who have historically been big in political spending join forces with the newer tech companies.
Well, and of course, Facebook had been a supporter of the opponents. They were on board with $200,000 mm-hmm. to defeat it. And then after Mark Zuckerberg's grilling in Congress, they backed away. So they won't be putting any more money in.
Although it's not clear. I mean, they haven't endorsed it. So I doubt that they're behind it. I think they just don't want the bad press.
Right, exactly. But, this is one of those issues where, right now with the Cambridge Analytica stuff and Facebook, everybody's very focused on privacy. And I think if there were a poll taken on this, it would do extremely well. But, there's going to be a whole campaign around this. It'll be interesting to see what the opponents do to, bring those numbers down.
Yeah, money talks. I mean, I was speaking with a spokesman for the opposition yesterday, and they're basically saying this would cut California off from the rest of the world, that you can't sort of create one set of rules for the internet in California, that the World Wide Web is worldwide.
It's not the California Wide Web,
right.
I think was the quote.
Yes. But they're also saying, we would prefer this was sort of a global approach, which is basically saying let the companies do it themselves.
Well, and it comes at a time when President Trump signed a repeal recently of some Obama-era regulations around privacy to protect consumers. Those have gotten rolled back. And I think there's been an effort in Sacramento maybe to bring some of those back, at least in California. But, there's stiff opposition to that as well.
Well, right. And I think that's why this is ending up on the ballot, is that we have seen no effort in Sacramento to really, really tackle this issue. And again, because guess who spends a lot of money on lobbying up there?
AT&T
all of these folks.
And Verizon and all the rest of them,
The other big thing going into this weekend is...
You're going to San Diego.
I am headed to San Diego for the GOP convention. So this should be fun. We've got a big weekend for the two gubernatorial candidates, Travis Allen, Assemblyman John Cox, a businessman. In recent polls, they are actually in second and third-ish place. There's some squishiness there because the polls are all different.
Yeah, exactly. But, one of the big things they're going to do is they're trying to do an official endorsement. Somebody's got to get 60% of the vote from the delegates. And seems like they're circling the wagons for John Cox.
Party leadership is. We saw today
Kevin McCarthy, yeah. Jeff Denham, some of the names in the congressional delegations coming out for John Cox. He's got the dough. He's put in, $3 million plus of his own money.
Which is pretty impressive because Travis Allen has raised nothing in political terms comparatively. I think about $800,000 maybe in the last one.
And how much do you think of this circling the wagons of the leadership for Cox is about? Cox is more viable versus love lost for Travis Allen.
I mean, I think everything. I think, Travis Allen speaks to the party base in some ways. He's very sort of bombastic. He's sort of tried to tie himself more to Trump around. I mean, let's face it. They're both talking about tax cuts and immigration and attacking sanctuary laws. But Travis Allen, I think, is a much less sort of centrist candidate, if you can call Cox that. And I think the GOP leadership would much prefer to see him get this endorsement because they'd like to see him try to beat out Villaraigosa to November.
Exactly, because they've got a lot riding on that. Because if November comes around and it's not a presidential year, there's no Republican at the top of the ticket for governor or the Senate, which is entirely possible, they're going to be relying on the gas tax repeal and sanctuary state kinds of things to
get
voters out.
Which brings us to congressional races.
And what about them?
Well, just that if there's two Democrats on the governor ticket, I think it's going to be a lot harder in some of those districts that Democrats are targeting to win.
Sure, but the Democrats, of course, have their own problems. They've got to get to the top two themselves, which in some of those races in San Diego and Orange County is going to be tough.
This is true.
Mike Pence was in town also raising money with Kevin McCarthy for these candidates. You know, people like David Valadao and Hanford and Steve Knight in Palmdale. You know, they're not chairs of juice committees. They don't live in places with a lot of constituents that have a lot of money. So it's really critical for McCarthy to steer money toward them to, you know, try to save them.
Absolutely. And we should note, next week, there's a governor's debate. You will be on the panel asking the questions of all of these fine gubernatorial candidates. Should we expect?
Oh, I'm not going to tell you. No, I think, you know, Chuck Todd from Meet the Press is the moderator. I think it's going to be lively. You know, there's a lot riding on the. It's probably going to be certainly the biggest audience these six candidates are going to have between now and the election. And it'll be interesting to see who attacks who. You know, most of the polls show Gavin Newsom is fairly secure at the top. It's a real free-for-all for number two. But can they resist attacking Gavin Newsom, you know, especially John Cox and Villaraigosa?
I think they'll definitely attack Gavin Newsom. But, like, how much and where do they focus? Because you're right. I think at this point, Allen, Cox, and Villaraigosa are all really vying for that number two spot. And so in some ways, it doesn't really make sense to spend, you know, your 30-second response attacking the guy who's 15 points ahead of most of everyone.
But I agree with you. I don't think they can probably help themselves.
Probably not. All right. We're going to take a little break in a second here. Coming up next, we'll be joined by San Francisco mayoral hopeful and former state senator Mark Leno. You're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio.
And welcome back to Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer, along with Marisa Lagos. And here with us in the studio, Mark Leno is in the House. He's a former state senator who got there by taking on a sitting Democratic senator. He did, a fellow member of the LGBT community at that, Carol Migdon. That's going way back.
We're going to
go further back. We're going further back.
That was a nasty race, but we wonder if it even stacks up to a mayoral race in San Francisco. Anyway, Mark Leno, welcome to the
Marisa, Scott, it's great to be here. I was so enjoying the banter on the state politics. You know, I served with Travis Allen.
And yes.
You, what's your
the
take?
Man has a special talent for self-promotion. It's rare.
And that's saying something in Sacramento.
That is saying something. It is a rare talent.
Well, we'll get to your Sacramento days in a second, but we like to go like way back. In
my bar mitzvah?
Before that.
Ooh,
Milwaukee.
So you grew up in Milwaukee, right? Was that
Milwaukee.
Where you were bar mitzvah?
Yes. Yes, that's where I was bar mitzvah.
What do you remember about your bar mitzvah?
What do I remember? I had a crush on a girl named Nan.
I thought you were going to say on the rabbi.
Nan. And was she also 13? Or?
Yes, she was in my class.
Okay.
She was tall and willowy blonde.
Nice.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what was it like?
And I was short and skinny.
What's the worst thing you did as a kid in Milwaukee?
Oh, gosh, when I misplaced my stamp collection, I can't quite remember.
Are you serious?
I was a pretty good kid. Yeah. I was a pretty good
Best
kid.
Best little boy in the world.
And you have siblings, a sister?
Yes, I have a sister a couple years older and a sister a couple years younger, and we're very, very close.
Okay, so I know one of those sisters lured you to San Francisco, but first you went to New York. Were you...
After college, yes.
Yeah. Were training or thought about training to be a rabbi?
I went to New York specifically to apply to and then be accepted to the Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion, which is a reform seminary. It's a 5-year postgraduate program. The idea would be that I'd complete those 5 years and be ordained as a reform rabbi. And about 2 years into it, I realized that wasn't going to happen.
What happened?
2 years.
I am an official rabbinic dropout.
What happened?
There was a first-year mandatory program in Jerusalem, which was fine with me. I had finished my undergraduate studies also in Jerusalem, so I had 2.5 years in Jerusalem, which was magical time, right before and right after the Yom Kippur War. And things changed dramatically. When I was there as an undergraduate student, the old city, I don't want to be in any way disrespectful, but it was like our playground. The Arab folks and those our age were so welcoming, and we had such a good time together. And the hashish wasn't bad.
Well, I didn't see that coming. I did not see that coming.
But after the war and my return as a rabbinical student, which also I had to focus on my studies a lot more, but when I went to visit some of my older friends in the old city, my Arab friends, they said, things have changed since the war. It's dangerous now. People are watching us. Everyone's suspicious. You can't come and call for me by name anymore. So things had really changed. But I was there at a magical era.
Did you, when you went to New York and you were thinking you enrolled, were you out at that time? And was that a problem at all?
So it's a very good question. I thought of myself as out, though if I had completed my studies and been ordained in the late 70s, it would have been 9 years prior to the Hebrew Union College actually ordaining an openly gay rabbi. So I was a bit ahead of my time, which was part of the challenge for me. There were no role models. There was no one I could, can I be a sexually active young man and be a rabbinical student and become a rabbi? Just a lot of unanswered questions. And
this is New York City in the 70s.
Yeah,
this is New York City in the 70s, the disco 70s. So when I went to Jerusalem for that mandatory first-year program, which was to bring everyone's Hebrew proficiency to a certain level for all the textual work that would follow in the coming 4 years, I imagined as I was walking up the staircase at King David Road that the folks in the administrative offices were looking down as my son thinking, aren't we progressive? Aren't we advanced and far-thinking? Or they were thinking, oh, here comes another one.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, right. So had you come out to your family at that young age?
I came out when I was 18 in 1969,
wow.
So I refer to myself as a Stonewall baby.
How did your family take it?
They had no context for it at all. Mm-hmm. This was a middle-class Jewish family in the Midwest. I don't think they had any gay friends, and so it just came out of nowhere. And because we had a great love for each other, my mother, my father, it was a tight-knit family, that we never got too untethered. But it was a strain. It was difficult for a number of years, and things only got better. And then I think once I started my business in San Francisco in 1978, my father, also a small business owner, and he had respect for what I was doing. I had a greater mm-hmm. appreciation for what he had accomplished. And so that relationship suddenly got so much stronger. But over the years, they've been my biggest fans and encouragers.
I know he just passed away.
He did just a few weeks ago. Thank you.
So you can't come out to San Francisco. Did you come here because it was sort of a gay mecca?
Well, I'm going to refer back to Marisa's comment. My sister, Jamie, was already a student at Stanford, and I actually found a letter that she wrote to me, and I'd remembered a line in it. I just found it a few months ago. She said, and I was struggling at the time. I didn't know what I was doing after I dropped out of school. I was doing odd jobs, but with no direction, pushing 25 years of age. And she said, get out of that cold, dirty city and come to California, she said, and revivify.
That is quite a...
Get in the hot tub.
Look at the California.
Yeah. And so I did just that and revivified.
How did you get into the sign? You have Budget Signs as your as your company.
Yeah, celebrating its 40th anniversary this year.
Yeah, like how did that come about?
Why signs? Everyone needs a sign.
People ask, how did you start a business when you were so young, as if it was such something miraculous? My actual and sincere answer was desperation. I needed to pay the rent. I had nothing to put on a resume. I didn't know how to get a job. I was selling clothes on Sutter Street across the street from Wilkes Bashford at a place called Paul Baduc, no longer there. But that's, I was just sort of kicking it down the road. And so I heard about a business venture to purchase a large letterpress, 2 feet by 4 feet, and the necessary type to make signs. This is literally Gutenberg technology, 15th century. I set cold type on type bars for 6 years in a 500 square foot space.
Yeah.
It is. Well, letterpress
along with vinyl records.
Is beautiful, along with vinyl records. But that's how I made signs. And worked hard, the business grew, and the rest is history. I moved from my 500-square-foot space on Geary and Masonic to where we are now in 1984, 85, and expanded the business.
What's the weirdest sign you ever had to make?
I don't know if we actually made it or someone suggested it, but I have a photograph of a sign that said, "Caution. Road impassable when sign is underwater."
That's like the watch out for falling rock sign. Like, what am I going to do if there's a boulder falling out? Yeah, that's great. And so I know it was at the shop that your partner and
my partner Doug. So there was a party called Metro Madness that the Muni was putting on as the underground was extended from the Van Ness station to the Cassera station.
Because no one knows how to party like Muni.
In the spring of 1980, that was
Muni station?
That's when Cassera station opened up. So to promote the new station, there was to be a party, and it was, again, 1980, so it was a disco party. The trains ran back and forth, disco
Muni
music.
Muni was so hip.
It was very hip.
And they needed signs.
And you may know Ken Maley was doing the public relations for it. Yeah. He had an intern named Doug Jackson, who was just out of college, and he sent Doug to Budget Signs to get some signs for the party, and that's when we met.
He was the love of your life.
And when he left that day, I thought, I want to see that guy again. And 10 years, we
did
had
you
10
go
years
find
together.
Him at the Muni party?
I pursued him that summer. He was with someone else at the time, but I stole him away. And he moved in with me the night that Ronald Reagan got elected president in 1980.
That must have been a mixed bag for you guys.
Not the kind of date you forget.
What, you were with him for 10 years?
1980
before
to 1990.
Passed away from AIDS, missed the cocktail. You didn't survive long enough for
correct.
That. What did you take from that, other than, you know, the love and affection you had for each other? How did that change you?
You've probably heard it described as a war zone before. It was that devastating, impacting everyone. No one was spared. It was at the door of just about everyone you knew. And you would see people walking down the street one week, and the next week they'd be 40 pounds less, and the week after that with purple lesions on their face, and then they'd be gone. And this was happening left and right. Thousands of people were dying very quickly. So it shook everyone. And in the first few years, we didn't even know what caused it. We hadn't isolated the virus until 1985, so there's no test for it. We didn't, and then there were all the speculation as to what was causing it, and,
right.
and why was it happening south of Market, not north of Market, and was it caused by poppers, or, you know, who knows what it was. So it changed when we understood that it was a virus and how it was passed, and things began to change. But then to answer your question, Scott, what really is memorable is how our community and then the broader community rose to the occasion. Because keep in mind, the President of the United States did not utter the words AIDS until 25,000 mostly young gay men had already died. I have a clear memory that when Ebola was responsible for two deaths in Texas, people were screaming, "Where is President Obama?" Two deaths, 25,000.
Yeah.
And you know why he didn't speak. It was because who was dying?
Mm-hmm.
No one gave a damn about us.
Yeah.
And we had to save ourselves. And we built a San Francisco model to deal with this, to care for people. And I have to mention that our lesbian sisters were there at our bedsides, holding our hands as nurses, as volunteers, saving the community.
Yeah.
So it feels to me, hearing you speak about this, that a lot of what you went through in those years you brought to your public service later. And I know that, you know, you were championing things around LGBTQ rights in Sacramento before anyone in anyone outside San Francisco and California was really ready for them. I'm just curious, like, did you know like you were ahead of your time? For example, in 2005, when it was 2005, I think, when Schwarzenegger vetoed the gay marriage bill. Bill, did you feel like you were ahead of your time, or did you feel like maybe we'll never get there?
So the timing was such that, and I was personally moved by reading the November 2003 decision by the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court. And they ruled, not unlike the Vermont and Hawaii courts before it, that there was no constitutional basis for this discrimination. But the Massachusetts court said, you have to remedy this discrimination, marriage and marriage alone, that no parallel constructs such as civil unions or domestic partnerships would do. So that inspired me to, let's do a marriage bill. And working with Jeff Koors in Equality California, we planned it all out. We got buy-in from different nonprofit and advocacy groups. So when the press went to them, they'd say positive things, because it was controversial even within our community. Some people couldn't even envision equality
right.
because we'd been denied it for so long. And we planned to introduce it on Thursday, February 12th, 2004, which was right before the Valentine's Day weekend, which would be the annual protest of going to the county clerk to ask for marriage licenses and to be turned away, except that year,
right.
Mayor Newsom decided, no, we're not going to turn people away. We're going to issue the marriage licenses. So it coincided. I introduced the nation's first bill the day that he directed the county clerk to issue the first licenses. And because of what he did, internationally, the debate changed overnight.
What do you make of Schwarzenegger now, so many years later, 13 years later, kind of leading the charge with people like Governor Kasich from Ohio to make the Republican Party more inclusive and more compassionate? Because I'm just wondering, did you have a conversation with him about the bill that he vetoed?
He never wanted to talk to us about it. And I want to give him credit for evolving, and I think we always have to do that, even with our adversaries. We gave him history on a silver platter. He could have been remembered in the history books so admirably. And the hypocrisy of what he was doing under his own roof with his housekeeper, impregnating her at the same time he was impregnating his wife, it's such a tawdry story. And that he was denying me the right to take vows with the man I love when he didn't have any respect for the vows he had taken. And I had hoped that he would allow me to bring in some same-sex couples, some same-sex families, so he could see the humanity of what we were talking about. But he was up for re-election in 2006, and I believe it was complete political expediency. His base would have been furious with him, as they were when he finished anyway, but he never took a real interest in it. And then after the political winds turned, he refused, as governor, to defend Prop 8 when it was in court, and that was his job. Jerry Brown wouldn't defend it as attorney general, and Governor Schwarzenegger said he wouldn't defend it either because it was unconstitutional, but...
Was that kind of a do-over, do you think?
It was a do-over, yeah.
I mean, it's pretty remarkable. 2005 was not that long ago.
No.
You know, relatively. And I think a lot of... I was in Sacramento covering
yes.
you as a state senator, and I feel like a lot of the fights that you took on up there did take many years, right? Around criminal justice stuff, around
yes.
privacy. We were talking about this Facebook privacy bill. I mean, you were championing some of that stuff several years ago.
Police accountability.
With Senator Anderson.
Yes.
Yes, my Republican colleague.
Joel, yeah.
But, I mean, what did you learn from that, the length of time it often took you? And you didn't win all of those victories. Some of them, like the police accountability bills, are still
right.
being debated.
Right.
But what do you take from that?
And Senator Skinner is moving it again now.
Yeah.
I did learn a big lesson, and that is ideas have their own time. Despite my force of will or anybody else's, you can try as hard as you want. You can try to change as many hearts and minds, but an idea has its own timeline of evolution. And so marriage finally got resolved in the courts almost 10 years later. But it's all incremental, and one thing can't happen unless the previous step had been taken.
I want to come into the present because you're
yes,
running
please.
For mayor. Why do you want to be mayor? And you know, we've talked about San Francisco politics being bare knuckle. Sacramento, you know, you worked with Republicans from rural places and got along quite well. What did you learn up there that you think would help you here, if anything? And why, fundamentally, why do you want to be mayor?
Sure. So first of all, I have always thought of this opportunity to serve in public office as a privilege and as a public trust and a great honor. I have a good time doing it, but I take the job very seriously. I never intended to get into public office. I was reluctant to even accept an appointment to the Board of Supervisors in 1998. I was busy with community service, which overnight after the appointment became public service. And I've loved it. I've loved the legislative process. I found out I was a closet policy wonk who knew I really love this stuff. And
not so closeted anymore.
To get a taste of the kind of change one can accomplish is intoxicating.
But as mayor, I mean, it's retail, right? I mean, it's not just
yes.
policy and sitting, you know, with...
Yeah, it's a very different
yeah.
sort of position,
it's
being a lawmaker versus an executive.
Well aware.
So why? Why would you
want it? Because the city I so love, and that has given me a life I never could have imagined 40 years ago when I came here as a lost 25-year-old, I see changing so dramatically. And yes, good in some ways, and very negatively in other ways. I think the city is out of control in terms of homelessness, housing affordability, crime, property crime, and the condition of our streets, immobility, the traffic congestion, and I think City Hall has failed us. So I'm running a change campaign. This is about a new direction, fundamental change versus status quo. I've not been in public office in San Francisco. I've not been at City Hall for 16 years. Other candidates have been there the past 5-10 years. And it's not working. It's not working. Everyone I speak to on the street agree. They tell me, what are you going to do? It's not working. And I say, I agree with you.
We have a few minutes left, but I mean, one thing you brought this up, housing, homelessness. I feel like they are top of mind, and all the mayoral candidates seem to have, this idea that they can really fix something that has proven very intractable, not just in San Francisco. I mean, what makes you think you can really do anything? We've seen, for the thousands of people that have been housed in San Francisco, more people just keep becoming homeless.
Yes. So I know we just have a few minutes, but I do have a very serious, detailed plan, and the response to it has been very positive. MarkLeno.com is where you can find it. End street homelessness by 2020. That's 3,000. It is ambitious. I talked to Daniel Lurie, who's so involved with this at Tipping Point, and he said, I like the boldness. It's audacious. And I think we must be audacious at this point. It's been too elusive up until now. And I can't accept the status quo. I won't accept that this is not a crisis and it's just the way it is, and we have to shrug our shoulders.
You're known as somebody who's very civility. I mean, you got along with so many people who were very different from you ideologically up in Sacramento. I wouldn't have suspected that you would have the slogan "Shake Up City Hall." I mean, do you want to fire department heads? I mean, what does "shake up" mean?
It means a lot of different things. It means that we do the budget differently. And you were there years ago when we actually did zero-based budgeting. So rather than just take last year's budget, put some more on top and move it to the mayor's office as a department head for next year without actually dissecting which programs within that budget brought us return on investment. Those are the programs we want to reinvest in, not the ones that didn't. We don't have the luxury to waste any public spending right now. And we've got to have the confidence of the taxpayers if we're going to go ahead and do audacious things. That's just one example. But there will be a top-to-bottom review of everyone who's there. I'm not going to name names. I don't want to be so presumptuous that I know exactly who has to go and who can stay. But there will be a serious review, and we've got to get this city moving in a new direction.
All right, let's end on a slightly lighter note, which is I'm just curious if you and Jerry Brown ever talked about your similarities in dropping out of his Jesuit medical school on your side.
We have talked about it. He suggested I had another failed seminary and managing my business for a while.
You guys all just come together.
And Jerry suggested that we call the place Failed Cleric Press.
All right.
Sounds like a punk band.
I think we're going to have to leave it there. Senator Mark Leno, thank you so much for coming in.
It's a joy to be here. Thank you.
That's going to do it for this edition of Political Breakdown. If you like what you heard today, please subscribe, rate, and review us on Apple Podcasts.
Katie Orr is our Sacramento reporter. Our producer, Guy Marzorati, and our engineer is Seal Muller. Ethan Lindsay is our managing editor. Holly Kernan, our vice president of news. I'm Scott Schaefer. Follow me on Twitter. I'm at Scott Schaefer.
And don't forget to tune in to Tuesday night's gubernatorial debate on KQED and public radio stations around our state. I'm Marisa Lagos. Follow me on Twitter at mlagos. That's a wrap for this week's Political Breakdown from KQED.
We'll see you next time.